Movie Squad is sponsored by Luna Palace Cinemas, WA's premier independent cinemas, bringing the best film content and cinematic events to Perth. Come and enjoy the Luna Palace experience.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Morato.
This is the podcast version of your weekly edition of Movie Chat, broadcasting on RTRFM 92.1, Friday mornings, 7:30 a.m. with breakfast host Pam Boland. And on the Movie Squad podcast, we discuss new cinema releases, new streaming releases. We discuss sequels to long ago blockbuster hits. And we discuss new horror movies that have blown up due to the marketing campaign behind them. So what are we going to chat about, Simon?
In the second half of today's episode, we're going to talk about Long Legs, Osgood Perkins' new horror thriller starring Micah Monroe and Nicolas Cage as Long Legs.
As Long Legs. I think this is the most... well, I'm very confident in the feeling that this episode is the most we'll ever say Long Legs in an episode. We'll also tease a bonus review in that later in this podcast episode, I'll have a chat about the new Scarlett Johansson, Channing Tatum romantic comedy Fly Me to the Moon, which is out in cinemas, and then will be bound for Apple Plus later in the year. But before that, we look at the sequel to the 1996 blockbuster hit Twister. We are talking about Twisters, starring Daisy Edgar-Jones and Glenn Powell and Anthony Ramos. And let's take a flavor of the trailer right now.
The once-in-a-generation tornado outbreak continues across Oklahoma.
We've never seen tornadoes like this before, and we need your help.
No, I don't chase anymore.
Kate, we can save lives.
I'll give you 1 week.
All right, fellas. We got PhDs from NASA, FEMA, and Kate, she's the smartest person I know.
Hey, dudes. This is interesting. Who are they?
It's Tyler Owens. Calls himself a tornado wrangler.
If you feel it,
Jason! Scared of nothing and I'm scared to death.
You know, our crew is not like your crew.
I can't breathe and I catch my breath.
We don't need PhDs and fancy tech. Sometimes the old ways are better than the new.
Well, you can always trust a guy who puts his face on a t-shirt.
Every Friday on Breakfast, we take some time for the cinematic arts. We look into the brains of the blockbuster babes. We're reuniting Simon Morato and Tristan Fidler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Love when you do it. How are you, Tristan?
Good. It's good to be back after last week's episode. And it's nice to be reunited on a Friday morning to discuss a couple of new movies.
Yeah, it is nice. It is nice. I have watched a lot of movies in the rainy weather recently, and I'm going to give you a quick hot run through of the things that I've been watching. Okay, so I've just watched But I'm a Cheerleader. Now, I feel like that's a heartbreaking thing to admit that I've only just watched that, but great, love it. Real hot take, you know, that
it's a great movie.
I've
still never seen it.
Simon, wow, you should watch that. It's very camp, very silly, very good.
Neither have I, but I've always been meaning to, and I think it's on SBS On Demand now.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Okay, well, I watched it on a cheeky download that someone had on their computer. So, someone gave it to me. I didn't do it myself.
No, it was in a paperback. No, what else? What else did
it
you
was watch? Great. I watched The Bike Riders in cinemas.
Interesting. I like to hear that.
I feel like lots of
another camp classic.
lots, I think, too much gratuitous violence. They got the costuming really right. Like, they're painting the picture of the time with the costuming and the set design, and it seemed to me like they forgot to develop the characters.
Wow.
But that might be just a real loose set take. Otherwise, I finished The Bear. I know that's not a movie, but it feels adjacent to how much we talk about Iowa Debris and the wonderful Jeremy Allen White. Anyway, gorgeous. Highly recommend. That's my watching habits from the last week, but I think we should get into your watching habits. Mm. Let's get into our first movie. Whether appropriate, we're talking about Twisters, Tristan.
Yes, Twisters. It's a new disaster movie that is a sequel to the 1996 film Twister, starring Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton. But it's a sequel in name. There's no returning characters or cameos, except for the contraption called Dorothy, if people might remember from the first movie. That's about as like connected as it gets to the original film. But it's produced by Frank Marshall, who produced the original, and it's surprisingly directed by Lee Isaac Chung, who made Minari, which I still have not seen, but doesn't seem like a clear move from that film to this, except for I guess being set in the heartland of America. It stars Daisy Edgar Jones, who people will know from the TV show Normal People and Where the Crawdads Sing, and then Glenn Powell. We talk about watching habits, Pam, and viewing habits. Here is a man we've seen a few times this year, Glenn Powell of Hitman, and well, you still haven't seen Anyone But You, Simon.
I am still the last of the triptych to watch Anyone But You. That was my promise, wasn't it, before the end of the year, that all three of us will have seen it.
Yeah.
And not to discount Anthony Ramos, who's also in the on the poster from Hamilton and In the Heights. But, I mean, the sequel to Twister, I mean, do either of you have a relationship to the original movie? Were you a fan of the original film, Simon?
I love the original. I remember seeing it in cinemas. Jan de Bont, right?
Yes, that's right.
Directed by Jan de Bont. And just a fun movie with, obviously, Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt. But a great, Pam, I don't know if you've seen it, but the supporting cast, you've got Philip Seymour Hoffman. Who else is in that supporting cast?
Well, because it's all about like people who are chasing tornadoes for scientific purposes.
Yeah, okay.
But there's a whole crew that Helen Hunt's character have who are these kind of ragtag bunch of heroes, including Philip Seymour Hoffman, who plays the character Dusty. And this is well before he was kind of understood to be he's more in a very party fun mode in that movie. But Alan Ruck from Succession is in there.
Jeremy Davies.
Todd Field, who would later go on to direct Tar, is in there. And Zach Greenia, Carrie Ewells. There's a nice cast, and it's a fun time. I think it's a classic blockbuster from that era. It feels like in the lineage of Jurassic Park, Independence Day, kind of CGI orientated disaster movie, fun time at the flicks.
Now, and it has iconic, just to say, like these iconic moments of like the Twister, burning through a drive-in theater showing The Shining.
Yes,
Then of course the cow.
What do you mean, the cow?
Wow, that is
so
interesting.
Of course, the cow. What do you mean? That's such a weird sentence,
that
Simon.
Is so interesting, Pam, and it's such an insight into the generational divide. Where
of
if you
course,
say,
"Of course, the cow,"
in reference to Twister, if 10 years ago people would be like, "Yeah, totally get it," but now it's lost to the sands of time. Twister, the movie, famously has a scene where a cow is picked up by the Twister and is carried in front of people. It was, I'm not even joking, a massive deal.
I always remember, like, there was an MTV Movie Awards where Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo hosted, and then did a parody of it. And the teaser trailer for Twisters had this moment where a tire, like, hits the front screen window of the car, which was not in the film at all, which they made a joke about. But, like, it was very effects-heavy, and I was reading about the creation of the film, and it really started because someone made a demo reel with CGI in terms of, like, this would be a great sequence, and then they built a movie on the back of that. So this is a sequel that's been kind of thought about for a while. There was also a moment where Helen Hunt was kind of, like, in talks to direct a sequel that never came to fruition. Here we have, two up-and-coming stars, together in the movie to kind of replace those characters. And we open with a fresh-faced and excited Kate Cooper, played by Daisy Edgar Jones, who's a grad meteorologist student. She's got a plan on how to thwart twisters and tornadoes. She goes out with her boyfriend and her friends to do kind of like, to set off this mechanism in the path of a twister. Unfortunately, things don't go to plan, and many people unfortunately taken out of the movie quite quickly, except for one of the remaining survivors, who is played by Anthony Ramos Javi. And so 5 years later, she's in New York working as a meteorologist. He has been in the army. He comes to her and says, "We've got the technology now to do what we tried to do back then. I want you to come with me and my corporate team to pick up with where we left off and chase these tornadoes and set these machines off." So she reluctantly agrees, and yet she is also kind of she's one who can really tune in with a twister. So she'll look at the clouds and she'll know when it's, you know. But she's also got a bit of a friendly rivalry with a social media superstar called Tyler Owens.
This Glenn?
Yeah. So he plays like the, you know, the Mr. Beast equivalent of a storm chaser.
My goodness.
Who's got cameras and a crew and, you know, see, he's got the cowboy hat. He's like really, you know, obviously cocky. And but, you know, they have a friendly rivalry where they kind of like try to chase each other to get to the twister. And he's got an interesting crew as well, including Sasha Lane from American Honey, Tunde Adebipi from TV on the Radio, who's in it, and Katie O'Brien from Love Lies Bleeding, which is a film I know you both love. And it's funny to see, I haven't seen that film yet, but to see a film that she was like the main star of, and she's just kind of in the background of this. But she's in there as well.
Okay.
Yeah. But basically, this is a film where you get the kind of the sparks flying between Daisy Edgar Jones and Glenn Powell and the special effects sequences, some of which were quite good. There's a really great sequence where a tornado happens at a late night rodeo, which I think was probably the best sequence for me. But there's something about this film that is quite curious in that I feel like with Lee Isaac Chung directing, there's an attempt to make this into more of a kind of a film with characters and to take its time to kind of tell the story. And the story was developed by Joseph Kaczynski, who directed Top Gun Maverick. And I feel like that's what they're aiming for, a kind of legacy sequel that gives heart and space to the characters. But I feel like even though they do this, the characters are still quite generic. So there's a lot of time spent with Daisy Edgar Jones' character going through the trauma of what she's experienced. So this film, I thought, was okay. There were some likeable performances, some good moments. Some people really like it. Others kind of find it a bit middle of the road. But I thought it was okay. I think the cast, really, I enjoyed all the performances there. And the cliches as well, I enjoyed. So, look, I don't know. Twisters, will you race out to the cinemas to see it, Simon?
I am very excited to see it. It's so funny whenever someone says the title, like, I just get the intrusive thought of
the cow?
No, not the cow.
The cow.
No, the title. Look, you know, the phrase purple nurple, are we afraid with that?
What?
You know, so that's what.
What is a purple nurple?
All right, okay, I'm definitely not going to explain that one. But
okay.
Nonetheless, I am excited by the prospect of Twisters. I can't believe it's taken 28 years to make. But Tristan, on that point, how is the spectacle?
Well, that's the thing, because I think when the first one came out, it was kind of riding high on the development of CGI to kind of, you know, put you in the, like, what we couldn't do before, which is to show, like, a twister to go into the eye of the storm.
Okay.
Whereas it feels now a bit, like, I think there's some really compelling sequences, but after a while, it kind of got a bit the same, or samey for me. And it's a weird element where it's trying to be, I think disaster movies generally where they go, whoa, look at the destruction and the awesome power, and then they'll do some like shots of the town that's been destroyed and have the characters kind of feel sad about it. And then you just kind of, you have to move on from that because it's all about the kind of spectacle rather than the actual.
Right.
And there was an interesting thing where some people talk about whether this should have like included conversations about climate change. I think there's like, you know,
it doesn't mention it at all.
A little bit of a mention, but it's not really like developed as part. The only thing that kind of brings this up to our era is the idea of Glenn Powell's character being like a social media
right.
superstar or whatever. Everything else is kind of just kind of the same as the film from 1996. So, but like, I know it sounds like you haven't seen the original Twister,
yeah, I haven't.
Pam, but. But this cast, I know you're a fan. Is this enough to get you into the cinema?
I don't know. Look, yeah. They're working their absolute hardest with that PR campaign. I cannot escape it. I have we were speaking about this a little off air, but we've witnessed there's a Hot Wings like eating festival that they've done as part of the PR where they're fighting that. They've, you know, Daisy Edgar Jones has never posted so much on Instagram in her life. I'm like, who is this? I understand you to be Quiet Marianne from Normal People. This isn't yours. She's like a superstar. They're doing the Charlie XCX Apple dance together. Yeah. There's a lot going on. So I do feel like this movie is working hard to capture a generation of people that are chronically online and, you know, attached to these superstars. And I think that's probably part of the casting in, you know, trying to capture different audiences with casting these kind of icons and people that are really of the moment. I tell you what, Glenn Powell is winning me over a little bit with this PR campaign. I kind of found him a little bit too shiny Ken previously, even with Anyone But You. You know,
Sure.
He was a little bit too the actual character that Ryan Gosling was playing in Barbie, not Ryan Gosling, like the actual character.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's winning me over a little bit. He looks a little softer, a little like more lived in this character in this movie or this persona that he's embodying, at least a part of the press that I'm, you know, like not looking for but witnessing. So I'm kind of interested, but I also don't know if I'm a big fan of disaster movies because I kind of just want to understand the relationships that are going on between these people. I don't know why you would go out and chase a storm. That sounds like a terrible idea.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of the thrill of the original film was that they were kind of scientists who were a bit like cowboys. And Glenn Powell here is like an actual cowboy. There's a scene where he kind of like strides out wearing a cowboy hat and a tight white T-shirt in like in the rain. And it's very much like a romance novel coded moment. But yeah, he is quite charming in it. And it lives up to this kind of persona that he's kind of developing in the
How's
promo
Stacey
circuit.
How's Stacey Edgar Jones's accent in this? Because she's English.
Yes, she's good, though my partner did remark she has a lot of costume changes. So she'll go back to her home and then you'll see about like three different scenes where she's got different kind of like cut-off T-shirts on. So that was the main thing.
Well, like Grand Theft Auto where she goes home and like she just changes outfits and then goes back out.
So, no, you know, she's quite good, even though like I think with any actor doing an accent, whenever they have to shout and yell, that's where it kind of might break a little bit. So if you want to be on accent watch during the movie, I'm sure that's a fun game as well. But Twist is out in cinemas now. I think it's the kind of film, even though that you're talking about the zeitgeist capturing thing, I think it's the kind of thing you could take your parents to or whatever. You know, you'd all have a kind of okay time and enjoy the moment. So yeah, out in cinemas now.
The letter was left with the bodies. We have 10 letters like it over the past 30 years. And all of them signed with one word. Long legs.
He'll kill. And kill again.
Oh, there she is.
You could have made nice with me. But you didn't.
Put the gun down!
And now that is the man. To all of this.
You're listening to Breakfast here on your Sound Alternative. We're in the midst of Movie Squad and we've been talking about Twisters this morning. I'm here with Simon and Tristan and we're going to get into our second movie for the morning. I'm a bit scared of it. Fear in my heart, I say to Simon, tell me about Long Legs.
Long Legs. This is a film that, much like perhaps the campaign for Twisters, has perhaps infiltrated your algorithm.
It really has, and I'm skipping.
And you're skipping, you're going, I'm going to flick, quick. This is a film that has gotten a lot of acclaim for its marketing campaign and emerged only a couple of months ago with teasers that kind of left the title out of the film and then these trailers that were particularly cryptic and most notably has spent the majority of the campaign not revealing Nicolas Cage, one of the ostensible stars
Didn't
of the film.
Didn't know that he was in that.
Nicolas Cage as Long Legs, as the opening titles remind us. He plays Long Legs, the villain of the piece. And then I'm being vague on purpose. It doesn't want to show you what he looks like or what his performance entails.
Oh.
And that has definitely inspired curiosity and has made the film a significant hit in the US, despite being an indie horror film. But it does star Micah Monroe, who you may know from It Follows and a few other horror films from the last decade. She plays an FBI agent, Lee Harker, in 1990s Oregon. And she's sort of, low on the ladder in the FBI, but catches the attention of her superiors when she preternaturally kind of guesses where a murder has taken place. And they investigate and she seems to have this supernatural ability or just incredible foresight and perception So they assign her to the cold case of the Long Legs Killer, Pam. And this is a spate of murders that have taken place across the state of Oregon.
A spate, hey.
It's a full-on spate. of families that have been found slain, right? It seems like the father or the man of the household has taken the lives of everyone involved. But at all these disconnected houses, there's one thing in common. A letter left behind, a cryptic letter left behind and signed by this character, Long Legs.
This was if I had sweepers when I would play like a Twilight Zone sweeper or something yeah, like
that. That's right. And the movie almost basically does that. So she has to figure out, well, who is this Long Legs guy and what role does he have to play in these murders? Because there's no physical evidence that he was ever at these houses.
Such a weird name for like a villain. Long Legs. I'm not. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, no, look, and that is part of it, you know, the mystery of Long Legs as a name. And it's sort of the film is ratcheting up to Lee facing off and meeting this character. Now, I'm not going to get into any of that stuff. We're not even going to touch spoilers. But Tristan, I know you've seen this. You watched it last night, I believe, and I am keen to get your thoughts. But one thing I do want to flag quickly is that Osgood Perkins is the director. He's made a couple of films. I'm not really that familiar with his work as a filmmaker prior to this. But most notably, he is the son of Anthony Perkins, who is best known as Norman Bates in the Psycho franchise, an actor and filmmaker unto himself. And a bit like the Russell Crowe movie The Exorcist, perhaps the most interesting thing about Long Legs is the fact that it comes from the progeny of someone with a history in horror. And again, like The Exorcism, I think I said The Exorcist, but like The Exorcism, the movie is kind of about this person's, this filmmaker's relationship with their parent or parents. I think the metaphor is pretty clear, and I'll leave that for people who've seen Long Legs to then go and Google and understand what it was like, perhaps, in that household. But the film itself, Tristan, I have to say, it had me in its grasp from the first minute, and then I could feel the fingers uncurling around me as it got sillier and, frankly, not scary as it progressed. How did you feel about Long Legs?
That's interesting because, yeah, there has been a... I think as well the marketing campaign has kind of increased expectations for a lot of audience members, and there seems to be a split between people who are quite affected and scared by the film and others who just don't see what it's all about. And the silliness has been something that's recurred. So I think going in, I had some more moderate expectations, and weirdly I found myself kind of getting more invested in the film when it got more wacky. And definitely the revelation, because they don't show you Nicolas Cage's character right away. It is a build-up, but the revelation of him plays into that, and I won't kind of get into too much about that. But then where the story goes and the kind of the type of horror thriller it is, you know, all of that, you know, I could definitely see how it could lose, you know, and it breaks the kind of the maybe the dread or the tone that's sustained. But I kind of liked how wacky it got. So there were some moments that I did find it had a kind of a chilling effect, more just the kind of the use of maybe jump scares or just the way that they're kind of intercut imagery. But yeah, I mean, I liked this film. I wouldn't say that I loved it or thought it was like a masterpiece. I think a lot of what it has is quite superficial, like the kind of the codes and all this stuff. It's all kind of window dressing. And the thing that I kind of could only connect to was this relationship between Maker Monroe and her parent in the film. And Maker Monroe, I think, is quite good in this, in that she has this kind of nervous energy that she brings to the role. And then there's some other really good performances from people who might recognize him from other things. Blair Underwood as her superior is quite good. And then Alicia Witt, who plays her mother, who people might remember from the sitcom Sybil, who played her daughter. I thought she was very good. But yeah, Osgood Perkins, I've not seen a lot of his other films. I've always been in meaning to, including The Black Coat's Daughter, Gretel and Hansel, and I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. But people might also know him. He's an actor as well. He was in Legally Blonde as a supporting character. But this film's a hit. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where he goes from here.
The film's a hit.
Yeah.
Is it?
But
you want to say something else as well?
It wasn't good. All right, like, and that's an acknowledgement I've had to come to.
Okay,
And I totally appreciate what you're saying there, Tristan. Mm. But you know, the film definitely, like, the codes are all there. Like, it definitely feels like it's trying to build dread.
Yeah,
and it's definitely, I won't say cribbing, but I think it's along the lines of Hereditary, the most recent series of Twin Peaks, Pam. But Tristan, you and I, a couple of weeks ago, we hosted a screening of Lake Mungo. We've seen that film a couple of times. You and I were sitting in the back row of the cinema. It's a movie that instills dread. It only has one jump scare. But Tristan, I was sitting next to you and you leapt out of your friggin' boots. And that is when a movie is working, right?
Yeah.
Like it builds to something. And I appreciate wackiness. I'm down for where this film heads in theory. But I think as a whole, and I think it's important to kind of know this going in, that really, it's more akin to films that have been inspired in the wake of David Fincher's Seven.
Yeah.
And the movies that were coming to mind for me, Pam, I don't know if you've seen any of these, but I'm talking The Bone Collector, Kiss the Girls, Don't Say a Word.
Do you think I've seen any of those?
I don't, but I didn't want to presume. out loud, certainly. You've not seen Don't Say a Word with Brittany Murphy?
That's right over my head. I like Brittany Murphy, though.
Yeah. Well, check that one out. And then maybe you'll know whether you like long legs. But yeah, for me, it was just, it was a procedural primarily.
Mm.
But the procedural doesn't really work because the mystery is only solved for reasons. It's not a film you can crack along with it or go like, oh, of course. And so when it then delves into the wackiness, I feel like the foot's just been taken off the pedal at that point.
The other comparisons that have been made, I've never played these video games, but a lot of people compare them to Alan Wake or Alan Wake 2 video games, or like an X-Files episode, or if people remember Millennium from the same person who made the X-Files, and that it's set in the 90s. It harkens back to that that aura of the kind of grim procedural, and it definitely feels like if they had cast another actor than Nick Cage, maybe the tone or the dread would still be there. But I...
but he's got... we love Nick Cage, he's got to do his kabuki thing, which is... And I mean that almost quite literally. It is like kabuki theater in the last act.
So, yeah, I mean, I like that, even though I knew that in the back of my mind, I was like, if it really wanted to get to a level of dread, maybe it needed a different actor. But I feel like Cage is always going to go like, you know, I want to go broad. I want to go like Lon Chaney. I want to, you know. So I think he's added a lot to it. And I could definitely understand what you're saying, Simon. And I don't feel strongly enough to kind of like fight for it or defend it. Like, I like the movie, but in the end, I think back on things that happened in it and just think, well, why did they do that? Or why, you know, like, I don't think there's anything really holding it together as a kind of story. It's just things that happen that kind of create a tone or like images that you have to kind of like wrestle with. So,
Does the imagery of it or the, you know, the soundscaping or anything, is that a saving grace? Is it a beautiful movie in one respect to watch? You know, does it have a saving grace in an aesthetic or something?
The aesthetic is great, but I think it's that classic thing of a movie has to stand on its own two feet.
Of course.
And you're watching and you're going, well, it looks great, but in the milieu of the film, it doesn't work. The trailers are better and scarier. Like, I don't know why, or I do know why, but what I mean by that is, like, as 3-minute horror films, the trailers are so much more effective, I felt, than the movie, because I did disengage once the reality of the world of the film set in, and the flatness of the screenplay, to be honest with you.
Mm. Oh, that's really disappointing. I really like Micah Monroe in Hot Summer Nights, which I saw ages ago. And that's the only thing I've really seen her in. And otherwise, I didn't realise she'd shifted so far into mostly making horror films or scary flicks. Maybe that's not the case, but it seems to be if she's had a past experience with lots of them. This is definitely not a movie that I'm going to go see. I'll give you the heads up right now. But, you know, do you think people should go to the cinemas and see it if, you know, they want to participate in, you know, or maybe they've been wrapped up in the marketing campaign? Or do you think it's a situation where you wait for streaming? I know you're not going to tell people what to do.
People can do whatever they want with their lives, but...
do you think it's worth seeing it in the cinema, is my question.
I feel like, you know, if you're inspired by the marketing campaign, like, it's the moment to see it, because I think, you know, seeing it in the cinema might you know, have more of an impact. But, like, at least to kind of lower the expectations, or maybe that might help. Because I went in going, look, I don't think this is going to be as good as I think it's going to be. And maybe I had a better time. But, like, yeah, I think now is probably the moment rather than when you see it later on streaming. I don't know.
It's certainly not so scary that you're going to be sick into your purse where they make some of these ad campaigns like, 9 people fainted. It's like, no, you're going to be fine.
All right, well, it's out in cinemas now. And Movie Squad, of course, you can tune into wherever you get your podcast. Tristan and Simon, for another great week, another great week of reviews. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, there you go. This is, you know, it's definitely maybe sometime we'll do a spoiler included breakdown of the moments where Longlegs lost you, Simon, and chart those moments where I thought it got a bit more interesting. But it's definitely, it's an interesting one to discuss, and particularly I feel like it's always going to be in conversation at this point with the expectations raised by the marketing. And then, you know, often, I mean, sometimes why I love trailers is because it's about the promise. It's about what it could be. And then when you actually see the film, it's like, oh, this is like everything else. But yeah.
Absolutely. There are some films where it's like, this is the most exciting part. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, like, this is the last moment that Longlegs will be a mystery to you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's quite exciting and fun. And I was so excited to watch it. But putting aside expectations, I mean, I'm still a fairly rational guy who watches a lot of movies. So it's not like this has been a thing that I've been building up to and, oh, my God, my expectations are crushed. But what I mean is, you know, trying to meet the film on its own terms quickly, which is just to say that I go, oh, it's a procedural.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it. I get it. Even isolating Nick Cage's performance, which I go, well, that's big, but it's fun, and I appreciate it, you know, for doing something different. It certainly wasn't what I would expect from a procedural.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the procedural element of it, and again, we won't get into the spoilers here, but Micah Monroe draws a line connecting the dates of the murders. And Tristan, it's just a triangle.
Yeah.
And she goes, well, this is clearly someone who believes in Satan. Like, as an audience member, what am I meant to do? I'm not going to... Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Shit. It's a triangle. Mm. So it's that level of procedural, like, where that's where, when I talk about silliness, that's where I'm actually going, oh, okay, this is what we're watching.
And that's almost kind of built into the, you know, the legacy that Seven created of that, you know, a serial killer is, you know, to be decoded, well, you know, by all these kind of, you know, references and buried clues, and that the we're watching these people kind of like tear it apart and kind of understand the thing that can't be understood. But
Zodiac is a great example of that, both in real life, but as a film about the unknowability of someone with that pathology.
But I agree in the sense, and I guess that was what I was referring to as well, with the fact that some of the things that are brought up, like Satanism, like it's, I mean, and you know, I can't hold it against this movie because so many other horror movies don't take it seriously. It's just a thing that you throw in there. Like it's a classic boogeyman that doesn't have to be connected to anything, you know. So there is that element where it is kind of a bit surface level. There's no real, like, you know, feeling of research or kind of going thinking through these kind of wacky puzzles and everything. But we're moving on from the darker terrain to the lighter terrain. I did go to the screening of Fly Me to the Moon, so I thought we'd throw in a bonus review of this new movie that stars and was produced by Scarlett Johansson and also stars Channing Tatum, and in its marketing is a romantic comedy. It is taking place around the launch of Apollo 11 and the first kind of the moon landing as well. So it's kind of got that from the Earth to the Moon. Tom Hanks produced, even though he didn't produce this, but that feeling of the kind of Americanism and the kind of the belief in reaching for the stars. Now, did this come upon your radar, Simon? Did this strike any interest in you?
I've not seen the trailer, and I was only aware of it like a few weeks before release when I started seeing them on the side of a bus.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, that's this definitely isn't a 30 Rock joke. Like, this is a real poster of a thing that's coming out. The broad... And I can speak about this because I still have not seen the trailer and I only know about the premise of the film.
Mm.
It's like, they're charming actors. I would enjoy them in a rom-com. And then I'd learned that it cost like $100 million, which makes me go to, well, is it a spectacle as well? Like, what is this film? Is it a frothy, down with love style, you know, 60s comedy? Or is it meant to be a bit more of a big budget adventure?
That's kind of the thing. I think it's trying to be a bit of everything. It definitely feels like it is kind of going towards that Rock, Hudson, Doris Day, and you know, the films that Down With Love was kind of referencing, with being a bright, colourful, and it's all about, basically the outlines of the story is that Scarlett Johansson is playing kind of sort of an advertising guru, whiz executive, who's able to kind of, turn things around with her pitches. She's kind of like this sort of like version of Don Draper in the 60s. And then she's brought in by a mysterious CIA handler played by Woody Harrelson to help with the campaign around funding towards the NASA program with the mission towards landing someone on the moon. Because, you know, they've done several missions now and the public interest is waning. Support from Congress is, you know, about being threatened to kind of be the taps to be turned off in terms of financial support. And then we have Channing Tatum as the kind of engineer who is there. He was training to be an astronaut at one point, but couldn't make the cut. And now he is kind of on the other side. But, you know, it's just funny to see, you know, when you think of like a movie like Apollo 13 and Ed Harris as the kind of, you know, but here it's Channing Tatum. And everyone else is wearing like white shirts and a tie. And he wears colorful, like tight polos or kind of like turtlenecks, you know. So it's a little bit of, you know, creative thinking here. But then, so there's an element where it is kind of, you know, being respectful and investing in that kind of the mission and the sacrifices that were made and being a little bit dramatic. But then it also has this other element where as they build up to the mission, Woody Harrelson's character is like, we can't risk everything on this one mission. We need to have this like fake moon landing that we can broadcast if the video doesn't work up on the moon, so that it kind of entertains the conspiracy theories around the moon landing being fake. So, I mean, I went with my mother. At the end of it, she liked the film. She had a good time. It made her think about when she was young and the moon landing happened. So, you know, on that level, it was good. It was fine. It is definitely too long. It is about like 2 hours long. And for a romantic comedy, I think you need to really aim for, particularly if you want to get to that snappy 60s vibe to the 90-minute mark. Scarlett Johansson, I think, is really fun and good in the lead role. Channing Tatum is interesting in that I thought he was good, but he's also, you know, you wouldn't call him Rock Hudson, you wouldn't call him George Clooney, but I guess he's adding a contemporary vibe to the proceedings. But
like, is he silly or is he very like?
Well, he's always kind of like cranky and doing that kind of, and his humor level is always like, what, you know, really, you know, that's the kind of, you know, so it's got that contemporary energy going on. But you always got to give it up for the ever reliable people who are actually funny, like Ray Romano as his boss always brings it, and Jim Rash, who people will know as the dean from Community, as the director that Scarlett Johansson brings in to fake the moon landing. You know, they do what they do, and they're very good at it. So this film, it was okay. The thing that I was thinking about it as well, and I don't know if this has ever occurred to you when you watch Apple original movies, is that it feels like, I always suspect, this is my conspiracy theory, that there's a technician or an Apple executive who's around there and talks to the cinematographer and goes, look, this is going to be on smart TVs. It's going to be part of the Apple Plus menu. It needs to look a certain way. And it feels like the MO is always, it's got to look sharp and dim at the same time. Because they were like, there's a scene where they have to visit like a Louisiana senator to get there, like, and they go to have dinner, and then the way it is shot is like it's Barry Lyndon. It's like by candlelight, and you're thinking this is supposed to be a romantic comedy, but it's like supposed to kind of. And then there are these moments where they really, it feels like very contemporary and going like, it's all about kind of like dark spaces and light sources and neon. So like, you wouldn't say it's got the aesthetic unity of something like Down by Law, which is very much going for the 1960s look. Here it feels very, like, shiny and... but also kind of, there's a lot of scenes that happen at night. So I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Well, no, but, I think there's some validity in that, your own conspiracy theory there. And because we know about how styles like that is a thing that is real.
Yeah.
And again, we also know why TVs are preset to have motion smoothing on. It's because when they're on display in stores... they always have those screensavers of, like, nature, or they're showing sports or something like that.
Yeah.
So I would not be surprised to hear that that is something that you could conceive of. Apple ads all have that same kind of house style, if you've ever seen an Apple ad before. So I'll say Killers of the Flower Moon probably doesn't fit that criteria.
That's the exception there.
It's an Apple film. And I'm struggling to even think of other Apple films beyond... Greyhound and Cherry. They haven't had a great strike rate.
No. It's and it does feel, when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, this is a, like, Apple Plus, they make lots of movies and TV shows, some of which I feel
they
like
they don't make lots.
Well,
that's their whole thing. But anyway, go on.
But it feels like they do, because they just, like, come out and then they exist. Like, it feels like, for me anyway, there's only a few that have gone, oh, that's, like, broken through to being, like, really good, like Severance or something like
sure.
that. Otherwise, you know, Presumed Innocent with Jake Gyllenhaal has been greenlit for season two. Great. Like, but I do, having said that, I should feel like I should catch up with the M. Night Shyamalan produced show, Servant.
With Nell Tiger Free from
yes,
the first Omen.
Yes.
Or C with Jason Momoa.
See, I even forget some of these original OG.
And we talk
Apple
about
Plus.
Severance. The second season comes out in 2025. That's two seasons in 5 years. What?
They don't like to do things by halves. So, anyway, Fly Me to the Moon out in cinemas at the time of this podcast recording, but it will be available on Apple Plus later in the year. Definitely, you know, it's the type of. Yeah, like if you want something that's not long legs, you can go see this.
Great. I reckon I probably will watch this at home.
Yeah.
Like, I think it feels like the kind of ease, like, anyone but you is going to be homework, because it's like, well, no one funny is in this. Like,
yeah,
who am I watching
it
for? But the idea of two very charismatic movie stars doing movie star things and a supporting roster, including Woody Harrelson, that feels like an easy sell on a Friday night.
Yeah, and it's definitely, it does have that feeling of, like, and sometimes when we think of romantic comedies, like, people hold up the great examples, but, you know, often the times a lot of the ones when the genre was at its height are, you know, they're just a good time, and you might not think about them the week afterwards. Like this, I can not recall all the plot details in this, but, you know, it did its job, even though it was way too long. So thank you, Simon. It's a bonus review for everyone who's listening to the podcast, but another fun episode of the Movie Squad show.
Thank you, Tristan.